Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 9, delivered on February 14, 2018. The title of this lecture is Structure of an Interest Rate.
Tonight, the structure of an interest rate. I do want to show you a couple of calculator tricks before I go too far here into the lecture. These are available on your TI 8384. You can also do them in Excel as well. I'll show you the TI 8384 version of them. And the book shows you a formula approach to it. And even if you ask for help with a problem in an assessment, it'll show you, do this formula. Well, there is a much better way, much faster way we have now to be able to do this thing. And so what I'm going to do, first of all, turn on the projector, which I oftentimes forget to do. And I'm going to go to the virtual TI calculator. And I'm going to show you something. Now, it's always nice to be able to calculate a loan payment. So I will start. Is that thing ever going to come on? Yeah, it's warming up. I'll start with kind of a perhaps an odd question. Oh, there we go. There's one, three, four. Okay. Now, who haven't I bothered lately here? Okay. You, sir, what is your dream car? Don't go crazy. Something that's reasonable, that shows you're a responsible citizen, but is attractive and reliable. What would be your first new car buy?
Model S.
Model S.
Yeah, Tesla.
I said reasonable. Expense, not insanely expensive. Oh, no, not Ferrari. Man, what's your major?
Information system.
Oh, you can afford one. Something that's... Now, you're a family man, okay? Then you live in a responsible neighborhood.
Probably a Corolla.
A Corolla? Okay. Reasonable. So, what I'm going to do here is, first of all, we're going to find out what you graduate, and let's see what a Corolla is going to cost you right now, very quickly. Okay. Google.com. Let's see what we got for a list price. Let's go for a good one, the LEECO at $19,435. Let's say that you finance the entire amount on a 5-year loan. So we're going to take it into apps, finance, TVM solver. 60 months, 5 times 12. Now, let's say that your APR on this is going to be 6.39%, 60 months. It's a 5-year loan. So we'll take the APR, 6.39%, divided by 12, go down, and your price value, remember always present values are negative, 19,435. And now we can go to the payment and say alpha solve. It'll be a $379.27. Okay. Well, that's nice. The next question you might want to ask yourself is, okay, how much am I still going to owe on the loan in exactly 3 years? Now, you could do the hand calculation with the formulas that are given, but there's another way. First thing you want to do is quit the app. Second, quit. Now, apps, finance. Now remember, it's going to still hold those values in the registries. And we're going to go down here. And we're going to, for the first one, we're going to find balance. Enter. And 3 years would be 36 months. Close the parenthesis. You still owe $8,523.53. Now, you could actually create, and I'll show you this later in the course, the TI can create a whole table month by month of these. Excel, you can do the same thing in very nicely. But there's your balance in 36 months. So here's an interesting question. Well, how much interest will I pay? Let's say over the first 3 years of the loan. Watch this. Apps, finance. Now you're going to have to go down a ways and you're going to find a sigma, a couple of them. You'll find the one sigma INT. Now the way you write this one is you say from first payment one, then hit comma to the 36th payment. Now, you could do it for any intermediate period. And then close a parenthesis. And that's how much you've paid in interest over the first 36 months of the loan, $2,742.16. You could also ask yourself, well, how much have I paid in principal? Actually, I know that because apparently, if the loan was for $19,435, and the balance is still $8,523, well, that would mean what? About $10,500. But I don't have to do it that way. I can just say, okay, apps, finance. And then I could go down and I could do how much have I paid on the principal, sigma PRN. And then I could say from month one, comma, to month 36, close the parenthesis, 10,900, which makes sense. Because if I were to have 19,435 and I paid 10,911, then that would leave me with that balance. Sure would. So these allow you to get practical information. Let me show you an interesting play on this. A little terminology. When we're talking about loans, right side up means that the market value, the current market value, is larger than the balance due on the loan. Again, right side up means that the current market value is larger than the balance due on the loan. Upside down means that the current market value is less than what you owe on the loan. So let's have a look at this car. And I'll do this on a yearly basis. But you don't have to do it on a yearly basis. You can do it on a monthly if you want to. But let's look at this here. Year 1 balance. Well, let's do it this way. Year market value. Okay. And then we'll look at the balance year by year. Now, old rule of thumb, and it's highly variable, but as soon as you drive a car off the lot, you lose about $1,500. So in this case, what that would mean is that at year zero, your market value, as soon as you drive that car off the lot, is going to be $17,965. I think that's right, isn't it? $1,500 off it. Okay. Is that right? Okay. So now, this car is going to depreciate at a rate on a car like that, maybe about 20% a year. So what I'm going to do then is do years 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And let's look at the market value. We're going to start with a base of $17,965 times 80%. So at year 1, $14,372. At year 2, it'll lose 20% more of its value, so we'll times that amount by 0.8. $11,498. At year 3, we'll times it by 0.8 again, and we will get $91,98. At year 4, times it again by 0.8, $73,58. And at year 5, times 0.8, $58,87. Okay, now. Let's see the balance on the loan. Apps, finance, balance. At 12 months, $16,027. Make sure you see it. Do you see it year 1? You're upside down on the loan. Make sure you see it. The market value of the car is less than the balance you owe, so you're upside down 1 year into the loan. Make sure you see that. Now let's see what the balance is at year 2. So we'll go apps, finance balance at 24 months, close the parenthesis, 12,395. See, you're upside down? You're still upside down. You're closing in on it, but you're still upside down. Now let's look at year three. Apps, finance, 9, 36 months into the loan, close the parenthesis, 85,24. Ha! Right side up. Right side up. Now, actually, interestingly enough, I can do this, and I do it in each class for a different car. It's random. But it's always about at year three that you're right side up on the loan. That's where we get into that idea that once you've got your income stabilized and you're in a responsible position and all that, about every 3 years you can get a new car and not have some balance from the old loan have to be folded in. About every 3 years, it works out that way for normal interest rates and all that. So that's why, and again, you want to make sure that you have stable income, you're not going to miss payments and all that kind of stuff, and you're not going to go crazy with your car, what kind of a car you buy. But at the same time, you should be able to flip this car at year three and even have a little bit left over for a down payment on your next car if everything works out. And you're not, obviously, you're not going to have accidents with the car and put weird bumper stickers on it and strange stuff like that. But there you go, a practical application. And like I said, you can do this month by month. Later, I'll show you how to do it as a table in TI, but you can also do it in Excel, too. In other words, every month, the value of the car against every month, the balance that you owe. And you can see it more in a specific framework, what's going on. In other words, which month exactly is it that you go right side up? Now, you probably shouldn't use that as a guide. Oh, the month I go right side up, I'm going to get a new car. No, just hold on till year three. Get a little bit of distance between the market value and the loan amount. But as you can see, that's a classic example of the right side up, upside down thing. Now, another one, let me show you real quick here, is this one. Clear. Who should I bother for this? Okay. For lack of greater creativity, I shall use you. You've got a great job in a new city, and then you realized you really wanted to come back home to normal Illinois. You wanted to be a normal person and live in a normal community and have normal family. Okay, so where else can you do that? In normal Illinois. I know, right? You're excited already. But you'll move them down here because you got a good job. I mean, all of them, even the dogs and cats. Okay, so you're going to move into a nice, Tony neighborhood like Ironwood. Very nice. I go there and, you know, the police follow me and stop me. And I live there. Okay. So you get yourself a $250,000 house, and you get an APR of 5.79% on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. Now, here is a really practical application, although it's not quite as practical as it used to be. I'm still going to use it, by golly. Okay, so apps, finance, we're just going to crank it out. And one reason I'm doing this is TVM Solver. is so that you get to the point where this just becomes more, just so easy. And believe me, if you do this by hand with the arithmetic formulas, you will really appreciate this. So you're going to have a 30-year times 12 months per year, so 360 payments, and it's, what did I say? That was a 5.79% APR, 5.79%. Remember to divide by 12 for the monthly APR. And the price value is negative. Always remember to put the negative in for the present value. And then we go down here to the payment. Alpha, about 1,500. 1,465. Are you out of your mind? What's your major? Okay, you can handle it. Okay. If you said finance, I'd say, nope. Other side of town. But yeah, 1465, that would 29 would be your payment. Okay? Now, here is an interesting thing that is very practical. Up until this new tax act, your mortgage interest that you paid in a year was tax deductible. Now, this new tax act has put that in jeopardy. It actually eliminated it in a declining way. I would bet you that that will be fixed as soon as people find out that that happened when they start filing taxes next year. But here's what you can do. Okay, I need to know how much interest. I am in my third year of the loan. Let's say I got it in January, okay? In the third year of the loan, let's quit this, and let's find out how much interest I paid from year two to year three. Okay? Apps, I think, yeah, I'll just do it that way. Finance. And we're going to go down there to Sigma Interest. And here's where. Now, remember, you're in months. So what I would want to know is from month 24, comma, 36, what number am I going to put on my tax return? Yahtzee, $15,176. Accounting. Look at that. You can actually, just right there on a stupid calculator, you can do it. You don't have to look at a bank statement. Matter of fact, I would look at a bank statement to see what they said. There are just insanely many stories of banks giving incorrect information. You've got it right there. That is the number right there for how much you paid. And so that's the number that you would put for the amount that is going to be deducted from your income for the purpose of the tax shield, right there. So that gives you a kind of a perspective on some of the things that you can use this for. And also for finding out when you're upside down, right side up, and all of that kind of stuff over time. So this has value. Past just a theoretical exercise to give you fits in a class, you can use this stuff. Clear this, and I'm going to put this off to the side here for a little bit. And I got to show you something else, something that's on a somewhat different wavelength. And I'm going to turn on the lights here because it creeps me out when I'm in the dark with you people for too long. Okay. Here's the thing. I'm going to take this off the board. Now, the first part of this seems like it has nothing to do with anything. But let me tell you what I made last night. Okay? Oh, that's just for special occasions, you know. I know. I go all out. Yeah, well, it's... No, treat is the other one. It's rip-off spam. You want real spam. You know, and it's not just for me. It's when I have companion company and I really want to impress. But here's the deal. I made last night this recipe. And this recipe called for 1.5 cups of sugar and 2.25 cups of heavy whipping cream. Now, in our common language, we talk in a way that's different from what we would have to do in math. So the common language, let's say I had a mixed number, 1.75, and I needed to multiply that by 3 5/8. We use mixed numbers all the time in our language. It's the way we talk about recipes. It's the way we talk about a lot of things. Well, how tall are you? 5.5 feet. Kind of short person. But that's almost impossible to multiply those two together the way they are expressed. We would say it this way. We would be pretty nerdy if we said, well, I want you to do 7/4 times 29/8. Even though that's the way we'd have to do it to actually do the multiplication, we'd have to turn it into the mathematical thing. This isn't a mathematical thing. This is just a language thing. This is our lexicon. This is the mathematical object right here. The mixed numbers aren't. The improper fractions are. Now that seems like, where in the heck is this going? It's just this. We have a lot of numbers and a lot of things we say in one way, but that doesn't mean that that's what it is. So for example, for this course, man, what is that? Read that to me.
8%.
We talk percentages. Well, what is the percentage rate on this loan? It's 8%. If someone said, well, the percentage rate on this loan is 0.08, we use percentages because they're common language. But they really aren't mathematical objects. We have to turn them into math objects in order to use them. Now, you probably think, oh, okay, you've already gone through this. We know this, yada, yada, yada. The next step, I'll bet you don't know. That is actually not a mathematical object either. It isn't, you can't use it. In fact, the mathematical object is 1.08, 1 plus. It is, the percentage is what we say. The decimal is what we mean, but the 1 plus the decimal is what we have to use. And so if I create something, if I calculate something, I need to use 1 plus. And what comes out, in order to turn it back into common language, I've got a minus 1 from it. You see this thing that I gave you before, the percent change is always the end minus the beginning over the beginning. That's what we always use, yeah. And that gives us a percent. However, if we need to keep going with that thing, we can't use that. We have to do it this way. End over begin. And that'll give us the 1 plus. Now, here's where this comes in. And if we want to come out of it, we have to submit. You, sir, have decided that you're so excited about finance that you have decided that you are going to go out and buy a share of stock. So, on February 15th, 2018, your world changed. You bought a share of stock for $18 and 60, and well, let's say 13 cents. You did a 1 year holding period on it. And you unloaded it in exactly 1 year for $20.03. Now, because it was exactly 1 year, something is hidden in the general formula. 1919, yes. I'm tired of time moving forward. Every time time moves forward, I look in the mirror and I think, God, time moved forward. And so did my face. Not that way, forward. So I'm going to do it by the end minus beginning over end over beginning. And then I will take away the one. This is the technically correct way to do it. Although I can do it the other way for a perfect one-year holding period. I'm just going to do it this way, the right way. Why does the calculator turn off? That just irritates the hell out of... Oh, anyway. Okay, I'm sorry. 20.13 divided by, no, $20, oops, my bad, and 3 cents, divided, close parentheses, divided by 18.13. Now, you got to be careful when you do this because, well, I didn't mean to put those, I didn't need those parentheses there. Watch out, because that will be 1 plus. When you do it the right way, in order to extract the interest rate, you've always got to do 1 minus. Just do it. Sometimes it will be very confusing what's happening. The number will look something really weird. Just subtract the 1. And in this case, a 1-year hold got you a 10.48% return. And here at the end, notice that we turn it back into normal language. 10.48%, that's what everyone understands. Here's the problem, though. Here's the problem, is that holding periods aren't always 1 year. They are what they are. So, in that case, let's say you, madam, went out and bought a stock tomorrow. February 15th, 2018, and you bought that stock for, let's say, $24.68. Now, on December the 11th, of 2023, you uncorked that stock and you collected $29.23 on it. The problem is that if I do end over beginning, I'm not going to have an annual interest rate. I'm going to have that holding periods. And we want to get everything in finance, and to a certain extent in accounting as well, into an annualized framework. We want everything so it's apples to apples. So that's why we're going to have to do some magic to this thing. And here's the magic. In order to annualize any interest rate you calculate, you do end, whoops, as a matter of fact, I'll just do it for this problem. I'm going to do 29... No, let me write, I'm sorry, I should write the formula before I go any further. It's going to be end over beginning. You take that value to the 1 over the number of years. Then you subtract 1 to get your percentage. To the 1 over the number of years. How do you find the number of years? Okay, right off the top of your head. How many years are there between February 15th, 2018 and December 11th, 2023? Real quick, how many? You can't do it.
5.667.
I had someone do that to me like 5 years ago in a class, gave me the decimal, and I looked, that's incredible. And he said, you mean I got it right? Anyway, I'll show you, there's actually something in the calculator that can do this. And I swear I can't remember where it is for the life of me ever, but it's easy enough to get the actual number of years. Not now. Google.com and years, or, well, you can do it this way. Let me do it this way real quick. Days of our lives. Isn't that show not on anymore? Between two dates, yes. There it is, date duration calculator. Watch this. Month, well, we want February the 15th of 2018, and the end, we want December the day 11th. 2023. You know, I was using one of these date things, and I wanted to see something back from my childhood and bring it forward. They didn't even have my year. You know, really? Anyway, don't include the last day. 2,125 days. But that's not years, but that's easy enough to calculate. All you do is it turned off. 2,125 divided by 365 days a year. 5.821917. So you weren't off that much. I mean, you're good. But I mean, you were at least you knew how many years it was, and you knew there was more than a half a year. So anyway, there's the number of years. Now, if I'm not mistaken, I want to go back here just real quick. Let me try, go back here real quick. Let me see if that, there used to be 1 year between two dates. Oh, yeah. Did it give me an option to choose years instead? That doesn't help me much, does it? I had this evil guy. He wanted us to bring it down to, he gave us the number of seconds between two times. And back then we had to first divide the months by 12, then the days by 365, and then the second, the minutes, the second, the hours, the minutes, the second. Anyway, never mind. Okay, so anyway. We've got the number we want right here. So what we can do now is we can actually, now, I'm going to do this sloppy. Generally, you would probably want to put this number in like a memory, one of the memory registers, and then recall it when you need it. I'm just going to do it to 5.8219. That's really not a good idea, though, because exponents massively explode rounding error. I think I'll be okay here, 5.8219. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to take, what was my ending value, 2923? Was that it? What was the end December 11th value? 2923. Okay, so I'm going to open parenthesis, 29.23 divided by, what was my beginning value, 2468? 24.68. Close the parentheses and raise it. Now, open parentheses. 1 divided by 5.821915.821917808. I guess I'll just take it all the way out. Like I said, it'd be better if you just stored that in a memory register and then recalled it, 1/ recall. Close a parenthesis. Now finally, don't forget that you want a minus 1. That'll kill you. I guarantee you. Just don't forget to minus that one in the calculation chain. 2.95% annualized return on this investment. 2.95% annualized return. Annualized. And that way I can compare that to portfolios I had or stocks I'd held for different times, or compare it to other people's portfolios where they had different buy and hold dates. This way we always create the annualized, and then we can compare any kinds of investments that we're making. And also, don't forget, even if it's like, okay, you're going to hold it for like 8 weeks. Well, that 8 weeks is 56. Okay, 56. So all you do is take 56 divided by 365. Don't even think about what number comes out of your calculation. If it's larger than one, smaller than one, you just take one over it. Otherwise, if you start thinking, well, is that right? Is it already a reciprocal because it's less than one? Don't even think about that. Just get the day, get the number of years, and take one over whatever number comes out. And now we've got it annualized. And we can do this for any kind of portfolio holding period, short, long, very long. We've got this way to do it. It was kind of surprised me. When I was doing consulting some years back, there were these people in this, a couple of finance people in this company, and they had a yield, they had an interest rate that they had calculated over a five-year period. It was a five-year. It was something like 30%, and they just divided it by five. No, that's not how you would do it. You would take 1.30 to the 1/5th power. They looked at me like I was off my... Why would I want to do that? Because that's the right way to do it. You academic people. Blah. Well, it's actually, over that period of time, it's a very different number. 1.30 to the 1/5th power minus 1 is not going to give you an answer that's the same. Let me show you. I think it was like, maybe it was 32%, but I'll just do that one. Watch. Let me take 30% divided by 5. It was a 5-year holding period. Okay, they said 6% annual rate. Okay, let's do the same thing the right way. That it was actually 1.3 to the 1/5th power. Minus 1. Oh, I was going to say, boy, that's a big... Oh, 1.3, close parentheses, to the 1 divided by 5. Close parentheses, minus 1. Oh, my. They vastly overestimated the annualized rate. Do you see that? They said 6%. It was actually about 5.39%, considerably lower on an annualized basis than simply doing a divide by 5 trick. So keep that in mind. You're going to get a number that's pretty wrong if you just divide by the number of years instead of raising to the 1 over those number of years. Okay, enough of that. Let me take this away. I'm going to put this over here on the side. Move a little bit away from math now and tell you the story of the yield curve. Now, when I say yield curve, for all purposes in this class, I am talking about the curve that plots the maturity of government-issued treasury securities against their yields. A yield curve plots the maturities of government-issued treasury securities against their yields. So the first thing that I would do is I would very quickly show you, and then we'll get back to it for a more in-depth look. I wish they'd let me have my... Treasury yields. Whoops. Okay, so I'm going to look at this treasury side. By the way, I'll put a link to this up for you. In other words, a yield curve. See, these are different treasury maturities. 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, 20 years, and 30 years. And the graph plots these maturities against the yields. Now, the first thing you will notice is that they go up. They rise. A little later, I will tell you that's because of the maturity premium. But, in general, a yield curve should rise because there's a greater maturity premium. But so, what we would see is it would begin with the 1 month on the yield axis, and the maturity axis would be over here. Now, one thing I should point out to you is because your scale is so weird on a yield curve, they do it logarithmically. In other words, the length of time between 20 and 30 years is about the same as the length of time between a 1 month and a 3 month. It's called a logarithmic x-axis. And so there would be a 1 month, and then there would be a 3 month, and on out. And you would see in a healthy economy, this would be an upward sloping. It would not arc too rapidly upward, but it would not lie too flat either. Here's the kicker where I tell you, magic, how you can see into the future, sort of. One way. That's a healthy yield curve right there. If it arcs up too much, that's unhealthy. If it doesn't arc up enough, that's not healthy. However, there is one that is so unhealthy that every recession has been preceded by this. Every recession that we have in our data is preceded by this one very unusual kind of yield curve. It's called the inverted yield curve. An inverted yield curve starts healthy, and then at some point, a shorter yield is higher than a longer yield. Every recession in American history that we can track has been preceded by a yield curve that inverted. Now, on the other hand, there have been, on the other side of it, there have been some yield curve inversions that did not lead to recessions. They just led to an economic pause. Back in 2008, in the late spring, I was still writing before my sites were destroyed by hackers. I was writing that we were approaching an inverted yield curve. There were a lot of other reasons I was seeing that we were going to go into a catastrophic recession. But I was pretty much one of those fringe people, conspiracy theorists and all of that. But what I was doing was I was watching the yield curve, and it was just driving me crazy. Because in the late spring, the yield on a 7-year was just barely below the yield on a 10-year. In other words, it was not inverting, but it was trying to. It was trying to. And it just kept floating. The 10-year was staying just a tiny bit above the 7-year. And then one morning in early June, for just a couple of hours, the yield on a 10-year went below a 7-year. Technical inversion. It recovered later that day, but I called it on my website. We have a technical inversion, and we will have a recession. And it will be a terrible recession. Interestingly enough, over the next couple of months, it just kept wavering. This 10-year would go above the 7-year, then the 7-year would go above the 10-year. It was maddening, but it was reconfirming. All it has to do is technically invert once for the call to be made. That's the signal. So, what I'm going to show you right now is, and I will put these on my website, on the podcasting site. I'm going to go to Google again. And I'm going to show you. Stockcharts.com. This is kind of awesome. Over here on the right, on the left, you see a yield curve. You see the yield curve there? Okay, now, just from what I've already told you, talk to me. Is this healthy or unhealthy? Does this look like a healthy or an unhealthy yield curve? Go ahead. What do you see?
This will cause speculation.
Speculation?
I mean, it's just getting a little close, yeah.
A little close? No, this is one step from lying on your back barking at the moon. Okay? There's nothing wrong with that, man, okay? Especially if it's a full moon and, you know, you've had a couple of cheeseburgers in you. I mean, you go, roar, 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 roar. You ever notice that? The dog is barking late at night. And someone leans out, what the hell are you barking at, dog? Does he really, well, I don't know, I thought I heard something. Does he really expect the dog to explain it to him? Anyway, try to stay on taxes, okay? That's a nearly flat yield. That's very unhealthy. But it's not inverted. It's not inverted. Do you see that the yields, there's no yield out farther that's below anyone that's in closer. But here's the cool part about... Do you hear that beeping sound? Is someone with a pacemaker going critical? I don't know about those things. Okay, watch. This one will show you the progress over 6 months. This was the yield curve 6 months ago at the bottom of the shadow. Now let's move toward the present. Look at that. Do you see how the back end on this side is kicking upward? Interestingly, and then watch this. Right here compared to right here. Do you see the distance? Oh, do you see that short end is pushing upward? It is moving toward an inversion. Now, does that mean it's going to happen? I can't tell you that. Well, yes, I can. It will. Right about recession. Look at right here. Watch how the long end is not going up as fast as the short end. So this part is actually trying to push upward and get into the other part, get above the other part. So when we're in a recession, okay, once this happens, and it could float here. I mean, it just drove me crazy. It floated for more than a month and a half, 2 months. But once it inverts, probably about 6 months to the recession. And in this case, it will be a pretty bad recession. So probably you'll see a recession that will last 4 to 6 quarters. So 6 months. So right about when you're trying to get out of here and get a great job. Oh, sorry, that was insensitive. The bottom line, though, is at least know where things are going. And like I said, I can't protect you, but I can prepare you. And you can prepare yourself. Okay, the greatest weakness is going into battle with no plan. Okay, so there's where we start with this. Now, that's a yield curve, and that's the inverted yield curve, and I've just shown you what actually, historically, one of the best predictors of recessions is the inverted yield curve, and now you know how to look for it. And in fact, right here, I want you to look. What you're looking for is down in these, where one of these rates out here goes below one of the rates back here. That's the quantitative inversion. The graphical inversion I showed you, but it's the same thing quantitatively. You'd be looking, for example, for a 5-year to go above a 7-year. So in this case, the 5-year right now is parked at 2.54, went to 2.65, so it went up 11 basis points today. And this one went up, the 7-year went up only 10 basis points today. You see that? How this one is moving faster, the 7-year is moving faster, just barely faster than the 7-year is moving up. So this one guy could close in on this within the next 2 to 3 weeks. Again, it was just 11 versus 10 basis points, but nevertheless, that's pushing the butt of this up in front of the nose. And that's your thing right there. Now, fortunately, I don't have any math to tell you about, but the next part is just words. The structure of an interest rate. What are these yields that I'm showing you? Is there some madness? I say the interest rate. Well, you know as well as I do that there are many interest rates. There is the interest rate on a car loan, the interest rate on a home loan, the interest rate you'll get on a savings deposit, the interest rate on a credit card, the interest rate yield on an investment. All of these are interest rates. What is causing interest rates of different kinds to be different amounts? The first one, the very first interest rate that matters is a substrate, a base interest rate that is underneath all interest rates. It would have to be something, we might not even be able to see it directly, but we would certainly have some kinds of interest rates that would be very close to it. So what I have to do is I have to take, you look like you don't want to be bothered tonight. You are walking along this long, vast stretch of terrain, and it's kind of sandy. And after a while, you're way up in the air, but after a while you notice that you've sunken down into the sand to your ankles. And you walk further, and you're at your knees. And you walk further and further, and you're beginning to worry a little bit. You're up to mid-leg, and then you're up to your waist, and then, thank goodness, you get to your neck, and you don't go any deeper. You found the bedrock, okay? You won't go any lower. But you actually did not find the bedrock. It can't be very far below it, usually. But you really didn't find the bedrock, but you know you won't go any lower than where you are. Do you know why? You won't go clear down to the bedrock because you're wearing a pair of giant Crocs. Right? No, 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 no. You wear Crocs, and you wear the big, huge one with a thick sole. So you go boingity, boingity, boing. Okay, now, here's, let's try to stay on task, okay? Now, what's happening here is that this is like interest rates. There is a substrate. That substrate is the bedrock and the Croc. We will, now, you will never see you will not see either the bedrock nor the Croc. Do you know why? You're in sand up to your neck. Okay. Any interest rate starts with something that all interest rates have. It is the base. It is called the risk-free rate. The risk-free rate. But this risk-free rate, which itself is kind of theoretical, although we have things that we can look at, like a really short-term treasury instrument, that's pretty close to the risk-free rate. But inside of the risk-free rate, there are actually two pieces. There is a real rate of return. This is the pure supply and demand equilibrium of money. You remember in your economics class they drew that money on the horizontal axis and the price of money, interest rate. Well, that was the real interest rate up there. And so you have the demand for money, and then they always drew a vertical supply curve and the equilibrium. That was supply curve one. That was real interest rate one. And then if the Fed, which it's about to start doing, it already has probably. If the supply of money falls back, you go to real interest rate two. Supply and demand, that's that real interest rate. We can't see it. We've got statistical tools that we can estimate it. It's usually not a big amount. Weirdly, a couple of times in your lifetimes, especially in the last 5-10 years, it's gone negative. I mean, that's ridiculous. Last time we saw that was a couple of times during the Great Depression. But there you are. Now, the other part of this is an expected inflation premium. No interest rate will ever be without the real the expected inflation premium. In other words, all we will ever see is nominal rates. Nominal means with expected inflation. And again, notice this is not actual inflation, this is expected inflation. Taken together, again, these two we can't see, but we can kind of do some pretty heavy-duty math and get a good picture of what they are like. We can't see either of these. And so this guy, the best we have is usually you'll use the yield on a very short-term interest rate, treasury instrument, because they are purely riskless. So for all intents and purposes, even though it's not the pure theoretical animal, it's close. And then comes Y, and this is underneath all interest rates. Again, it is underneath all interest rates. And then comes this three-part animal called the risk premium. This is what makes different interest rates different, because they have different amounts of this. The first one is a default premium. It is a reward or a premium for the possibility or probability that some or all of the cash flow will not be returned. The default premium is zero for a government borrowing because the government will pay you back. What would you say, for example, madam, for, let's say, a home loan? Would the interest rate charged on a home loan have a high or a low default premium? Got no idea? What would you say? It would be very low because it's asset-backed. If you default on the loan, they're going to kick you out and take your home back. It's even worse than that, you see, because all these banks with their crocodile tears about how we took these houses back and they had less value than the balance, you were paying, the owner, the borrower, was paying a mortgage insurance premium in every monthly payment throughout the life of that loan. It's called MAGIC, the Mortgage Assurance Guarantee, and it was on the borrower to pay that premium so that whatever the difference was between the house value, however upside down you were, that mortgage insurance premium took care of that difference. What's even greater irony is that thing, you do not, by law, have to pay that premium once the loan-to-value ratio goes below 80%. Almost no one knows that. They pay that mortgage premium the entire life of the loan. Thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. The bank has no obligation to inform you. They have no obligation to stop collecting the insurance premium. You have to go in there and demand it and watch them try to dance around and try to tell you that you have to pay it. At 80%, you do not. The next one, this is the only one that the government treasuries have. This is called the maturity premium. This is the one that's in the yield curve. It's a reward for the volatility possibility. A longer loan is riskier than a shorter loan. And I went through this, and I'm going to go through it very quickly once again. You, sir, borrow on a house. You want to live the life, live in the dream. So you borrow at 8%. If interest rates drop to 4%, you'll refi on me, and I, the lender, thought I'd get 8% for you for 30 years, and I get the money back, and I can't lend it out at anything but 4%. So I'm screwed if interest rates fall. And the longer the loan, the more likely they will. But on the other hand, if interest rates go up, normally you would flip that loan, you would go to move to a new house in 7 years, that's typical. If interest rates go to 16%, you're going to hold on to that loan for 30 years. And I would really like to have you give me that money back, pay me back, so that I can lend the money out at the 16%. You ain't going to do that. So no matter which way interest rates go, I'm screwed. So, and the longer the maturity, the more likely it is that that's going to happen, one way or the other. And then the last one is the liquidity premium. Sometimes they call it the illiquidity premium. Some kinds of loans, banks can unload to other investors very quickly. Mortgages are unloaded within hours. Car loans are tough. There's no secondary market of investors. Hey, I want to buy a million car loans. Credit cards are the same. So there's going to be this difficulty in getting rid of those. So there is the risk structure of an interest rate. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.